Lucas Barfield.
And I'm Uncle Dig.
Yeah. Welcome to the Cannabis Corner.
And we are back on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield, and we are joined by my co-host, Uncle Dig. How's it going today, Uncle Dig?
I'm doing fine. It's a beautiful day outside down here. My plants are reaching for the sky, and some of them are pushing near 8 feet, and it is getting time for flower season, so I'm excited.
Wow, I wish I could say the same. I was on your podcast. Folks, going to go look over at Uncle Dig's podcast, The Backseat Chronicle. You can hear all about my outdoor gardening woes this year. Nothing even close to that. But I did have a great weekend. Tacoma had this really cool event called Porch Fest, which is like a walkable street music fair. And right at the last minute, one of our radio stations that the Cannabis Corner is heard on, we were already signed up for Porch Fest, but right at the last minute, we were placed at a cannabis recreational shop in Tacoma, Mary Mart. And I just wanted to thank Mary Mart real quick for having us, and KTQA and Porch Fest for putting that all together. All the KTQA DJs came out and played the show, and I got to spin records for about an hour and a half right on Hilltop there in downtown Tacoma, Dig, and it was pretty cool. In front of a cannabis shop.
I really wish I could have made it, but I had a contractor working on my house, so I had to stay here and experience that. I really would have rather come up to Tacoma for Porch Fest. If they're going to do it next year, maybe I'll be able to plan a little better and come up.
Yeah, they are going to do it next year, I'm hoping, and I'm hoping that we can get back on that same spot right where we were. And I put up on my Facebook, and I was kind of joking, but not really joking. I mean, Porch Fest was like the biggest thing since the Tacoma Dome got a new roof. It's crazy. Okay. Everybody was sharing it, and my friend Henry Hagen, who is a friend of the show, recorded our Hemp Fest audio for us. He was out there on a porch, and he said at one time there's about 300 people out there, and it was going crazy over there. We were kind of off to the side, very side, live broadcasting, so we were in a perfect spot, but we didn't have the big crowds. But a lot of people did come out, and it was a really cool event out here in Tacoma for the community.
Awesome.
And I just want to mention our guest coming on later is Dr. Jim McCray is going to be on the show again, and he is here to talk to us about the terrible state Washington State cannabis is in, and the testing and all the things going wrong with the system here in Washington State. But we do have some good growers in Washington State, and I do want to recognize that. I know we sometimes sound all doom and gloom about Washington State cannabis, but there are some good growers out there and good folks out there. But Jim is a data cruncher, and he's going to be bringing us some interesting data with the 502 Washington system coming up.
I always enjoy talking to Jim, and I always enjoy getting access to someone who's so data-minded. It's really enjoyable.
And now, let's check the news.
This is a Cannabis Sativa special report.
So for our news, we're going to start right here in Washington, and we're going to stay here talking about this state. And something going on in Washington State was actually the first state for this to happen, because we had recreational cannabis first back in 2012, and that was these bans. And if you're not familiar with that, that is that a city and county can ban cannabis shops. And in this case, a little town over in the Tri-Cities area, which is over on the east side of Washington State. Did you ever get over to the east side when you were living up here, Dig?
I went as far as Yakima and okay. for some training when I was in the Army. I never made it out to Pasco. But this is where that's at. This is out in Pasco, right?
Yeah. And Pasco is in Benton County, I believe. And there's another county, Franklin County. That's the two counties we're going to be talking about. And they are just two of seven counties in Washington State that apparently still have these bans. And actually, Pasco is trying to push one more time to try to get their ban lifted. And they've had it since 2014.
Yeah. It says they passed it 2 years after Washington went legal. And it's interesting now because the city council that's active now in that town is consistent of completely different members, completely new council. So no one knows which way this vote will go. And what's also interesting is I was reading this article, and one of the people that's working to keep the ban in place said we believe that it may have a place in the outer commercial areas, but as many of our members stated, we want downtown to be family friendly. Mm-hmm. And I think that we need to push back on that and say, like, there's nothing that's not family friendly about cannabis retail sales. Your kids just don't go in. It's not going to like traumatize them. It's not going to hurt them to see a green cross or a green leaf. They'll be fine.
Yeah, and you definitely want to keep cannabis out of the hands of kids. And I totally 100% agree with that. But I would say a little bit, you know, just look at all the cannabis sales out there and how much cannabis is actually being sold on the adult use market, the medical market, and then you got the underground market. I mean, it's families are, or cannabis is around families all the time. So I too saw that, thought that was a really kind of strange outlook. But then there was another business owner that said that there was like 53 businesses downtown that wanted it to come downtown, and he said it's kind of split 50-50 down there. But you're right, the council is totally different, and they can do one of three things. They can either do nothing, which would keep the ban in place, so they can vote to overturn the ban, or they might kick it out to an election at some point. Which one do you think they're going to do, Dig?
You know, I don't know. These small town councils can be iffy. If they think they've got good public support, they might do a vote, right? But I think the easiest way to do it is just to put it out on the ballot, kick it to the people, and then it's not your problem either way. So maybe they'll take that way. I don't know.
Yeah, and that could be an interesting take because it could pass that way, although Benton County did reject 502. But if it's a flipped council, I mean, you can just imagine there's new voters in there, and that probably – I mean, it's hard to believe that 2014 was 8 years ago, but yeah.
I would kind of say the way I would prefer it is if they let it be a public referendum and just let everybody vote on it. I think that's the rightest way to do it. Yeah. I think that's the most fair-minded way to do it. And honestly, like I don't even think that's the best way for it to pass. I think if they put it out in a public referendum, I think Grandma down at the church will outvote us every single time, and I think that it'll get shot down. But I think if we want to do things the right way, we should let as many people who can have a say, even if it doesn't go our way. And I hate saying that, but I think direct democracy is always best.
And the next story, we're going to go over to Georgia. And there's some interesting things going on in Georgia, and they're having sort of a little modified decriminalization movement over there. And nobody's really calling it that officially. But on my count, I was reading the article, there is five counties over there that have done some type of decriminalization over there. But this story is about Athens, Georgia. And it has totally decriminalized cannabis. No more jail times. And if you get caught with cannabis, it's only a $35 fine.
Well, read the fine print. Did you read the fine print?
I must have missed that.
I read the fine print.
Now, over an ounce is still illegal.
Yeah, over an ounce is still a felony. So what they're
deciding to do. Oh, I missed that part.
Yeah. Well, so I looked up the law because what it says is what the DA in the article said is they're no longer prosecuting misdemeanor cannabis possession tickets, and it's going to be a $35 ticket. Well, misdemeanor cannabis possession in the state of Georgia is less than 1 ounce.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you possess more than 1 ounce, so I looked up the law. So here's the law: possession of 1 ounce or less of marijuana is a misdemeanor, punishable by up to 12 months imprisonment or a fine of up to $1,000 or public works for up to 12 months. So that's what they're saying. No, that's for $35 fine. Possession of over an ounce is a felony, punishable by a minimum of 1 and a maximum of 10 years in prison.
Yeah.
An ounce and a quarter lands you in jail for a minimum of a year in Georgia, and that is horrific.
Well, maybe if some more counties keep decriminalizing, maybe that'll change. But the DA does say it's kind of like a user warning there that outside of Athens, cannabis is still highly illegal. And maybe that's what she meant. Like, hey, it's this here, but if you get caught outside of this, you're still be in big trouble.
Well, and I think it's important for people to remember that this is why it's important that local politics still matter. Even if you don't follow national politics, local politics really can make a difference in your life. Because now you're going to have people who aren't serving jail time that normally would, because this local politician made this change. So please, if you're going to engage in any kind of electoral politics, please let it be local politics. Vote in your statewide referendums. Participate to a degree that makes you comfortable. But please, when you do participate, participate effectively.
Yeah, because no jail time all the way or up to a year in jail. And then all, I mean, they even said they could like put you on public works for a while doing, I guess, working, you know, work, doing work around the city, trying to pay off your fines and things like that, all the way down to $35. That's a really big jump. So hats off to Athens, and Dig is right. Make sure you are participating in local government, because that is what is going to affect you the most. So our next article and story we're going to look at is out of Colorado, and some interesting things going on in Colorado with its sales. Now, they are still selling. In January of 2022, they still sold over $150 million worth of cannabis in that 1 month. So it's not like it's too terrible. But they're having a little sales slump. And quarter to quarter, from December over to January, that quarter, the sales dropped 10%. And then actually they had a 20% drop year over year. So something's going on over there in Colorado with the cannabis sales, and this started all back in May 2021. Sales started kind of falling back down.
I think I read somewhere that Oregon cannabis consumption is down as well. I think what we're seeing is not really a reduction of sales from a new baseline. I think we're seeing a reduction in sales from a boom period. So COVID was a boon to the cannabis industry, because, you know, a lot of people, if they don't have to drive, they can smoke weed all day. It doesn't really affect anything else. They can do their jobs. They can do whatever. Right. Yeah. And they can't be called into drug tests. Right. So a lot of people were enjoying cannabis that don't normally enjoy cannabis so regularly because they were able to stay home due to the pandemic. Now, those people's habits or, you know, that stuff that they were doing, they're not doing that anymore. They're back in the office, or they're back out in the workforce, or they're just back out doing stuff, so they're not consuming as much cannabis. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, during COVID, it was kind of cannabis amateur hour, right? You had a lot of passionate new users, you know, driving a boom in sales. And now we're going to return to pre-pandemic baselines, which are still excellent.
Yeah.
But we weren't ever looking at an infinite growth at the rate it was growing. That was crazy. That was boom times. That's over.
Yeah, and I've been noticing that too. They are saying there is sort of a slump in the cannabis industry and a slump in the capital markets and just a slump in everything in general.
Well, and something else you got to consider is a lot of these business loans that people took.
Yeah.
Like are starting to come due, and they're probably starting to affect stuff. Because I know that like a lot of people who were in cannabis and who have been in cannabis and who've been invested in cannabis were extremely over leveraged.
Yeah.
And so a lot of that stuff may be coming due. So we may be seeing that from two sides as well.
Our last story is out of Canada to the north. And now Canada has been doing cannabis for a long time. They did their medical way back in the 90s. And then I think their adult use was even 2005, I kind of lost track, but they've had this going on for a long time. But in 2008, Canada passed a law that said that veterans could get reimbursed for cannabis there in Canada for their medical cannabis, and they've just seen a boom with that, and they say there's no sign of that slowing down.
This is very good. I think that RVA should do something like this. I don't think we're anywhere near close, but I think that they should.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know about you, Lucas, but I would love to talk to a Canadian veteran about this program in some more detail if we could one day. So if anyone's out there listening, we'd love to ask you some questions about this at the user level, kind of what your experience with this program has been like. It is a really interesting article. You know, overall, I think the coverage of this is fairly positive. I did see someone voice concern in the article about veterans using cannabis to avoid dealing with their psychological trauma. And I don't think that's correct. I think just like any medicine that does something to your brain, cannabis, you know, has, you know, some side effects, whatever those are. But the side effects of a lot of these medications that the VA in America gives anyway, I don't know about the VA in Canada, but I know that a lot of these other meds they put us on are much more dangerous than cannabis and much harder to stop if you want to. And I would also say that, like, if you're worried about people kind of running from their trauma for the rest of their lives, or being like altered, you know, in a way that you don't like after going to war, then stop sending them. That's what I'd say about that. Because some people go, you know, and they join the army and they're never the same again. And that's just part of it.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm glad you said that. And that's kind of something I could bring up real quick that I've noticed with the United States VA and some of the movement going on with cannabis and more psychedelic drugs. Is sometimes I feel like the VA is moving it forward to say, hey, we can put these guys in war, these guys and gals in war, and mess them all up. But hey, look, we can bring them home and then give them some mushrooms and fix them all up. So I really do feel what you're saying. And I'm hoping Canada is not kind of using this cannabis program as like, okay, we can still send people over and mess them up at war, but then we'll just come home and they can get free cannabis. So I'm not a veteran, but I kind of have thought those same things too.
Yeah, and I think it's a longer conversation. The VA is a very weird department, and it's very interesting, you know, how one of the largest like public health care providers in the United States is for veterans, and it's just a very interesting cultural thing that one could do like a whole podcast miniseries on, I think.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Quality West Cannabis. Learn more at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com. And we are back for this week's interview. And this week we are joined by Dr. James McCray of Straightline Analytics. And he is here today to talk to us about some Washington State topics. I know we've been sort of straying out to the international fields and looking around the United States with our guests lately, but we're going to pull it back into Washington State this week. And we are lucky to have Dig on the call with us today, too. How's it going today, Jim?
It is going very well today. It's beautiful. Sunny day it's looking up to be, and we need more of those around here.
Yeah, we are still in the rain over here in Tacoma, but we're going to jump right into our questions. And you have been taking some deep dives into some Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board data, and you have found some very interesting things, and you're here today to talk to us about that. And I want to start with, they have a new quality control system they rolled out, and they said that they, being the Liquor Control Board, that they were going to be testing all cannabis flower and products in the state for pesticides. And yep. We wanted to have you on to make a comment on that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, your timing is great. Well, a few things. By history, I've done a fair bit of stuff with the lab data over the years, and showing, I think, the two primary things that are of interest, at least they were 4 or 5 years ago when I first published this stuff. It was fairly common to see inflation of cannabinoid levels, reported cannabinoid levels, in flower and in concentrates, but primarily in flower. And it was also pretty evident that some labs were differentially, you know, putting out higher such numbers. And some labs, and often it's the same labs, were also having a tendency to fail a lower, and in some cases, much lower proportion of the product for quality assurance, quality control purposes. So basically, you know, I came over years of looking at that stuff, not only in Washington State, but now in a number of states, that, you know, certainly in Washington, you know, at that time, it was almost as if the market was a large consumer fraud. You know, it's just in terms of if people thought they were, you know, paying, well, they typically were paying more for higher cannabinoid content and things, thinking they're getting better value as a result, being told by the regulated label that they're getting more, you know, all lab tested. It's one of the big advantages over the unregulated market of old, that we now have all this good quality assurance testing. Well, there was pretty darn clear evidence of massive consumer fraud and quality assurance things that concern me, certainly from consumer safety, but even more so for patient safety or anybody that's really of sensitive immune system or other, you know, constitution. So that was the status then. But, you know, of course, the LCB had the BioTrack seed to sale traceability system, which had pretty good data. And that enabled myself and other people to look at the data across farms, across labs, across time, across strains, all, you know, all kinds of stuff. And it became clear that there was a very, you know, there was a pattern. If enforcement was not sensitive to this or enforcement was not acting against this, very quickly, the market, which in large cases, the farmers and the processors, became aware of where they could get higher cannabinoid numbers, higher potency numbers, as some people like to call them. And, you know, just, oh, by the way, as well, they're less likely to fail one of my batches, which means I can't sell it the way it is. So those labs very, very quickly come to prominence. I mean, there's instances where one of the quote-unquote bad labs that had been suspended for quite some time came back into business under a different name and all. But unfortunately, by then, the LCB had moved to the LEAF data system, which had a little bit less transparency into the lab data and some other data, but that's just me bitching. The point is, when they came back into the market, they were back up to being one of the, if not the major lab in the state within, I think it was as little as 4 months of them returning to the market. So there was a lot of old customers that really welcomed them back with open arms. And anyway, go down the road a little bit further, and now we're in a world where, long answer to a short question, but now we're in a world where the LCB has just rolled out its own data system, its own, they're not even calling it a seed-to-sale traceability system anymore, because it isn't. They're calling it a compliance reporting system, which I gather it meets their needs for. I don't completely understand those. But with that system, I've just begun looking in detail now that we have a few months of data into it, 6 months of data. And just the past week, I've been looking closely at the lab data, and it's a bit messy. So this stuff's all very, very preliminary. But your question about pesticides, back to the original question, when I look at the trend of just a couple of required pesticides that for testing, I'm just looking at a very small subset of the data here. But it's clear that with the change, which took effect basically April, early April, first or second, that pesticide testing was now required in the market outside of just the DOH, MMJ certified product. There was, you know, a jump. You know, it looks like there were about 1,900 tests done in the months of April and May, which is, you know, a lot. That's a lot more than there were under the medical days, for sure. So, but one problem I've got with these data is prior to April 2nd, it looks like actually prior to March 8th, there's no data that I can see. What's the earliest date I've got here that's meaningful? Yeah, there's very little data on pesticides prior to March, if any. So it looks like when they transitioned to the new system, they basically couldn't even record the properly the DOH medical data in the system. And now we've got a system where it's out there. So there's a lot more pesticide testing now going on than there used to be. Long answer. However, and this was just to round the story around, and then we'll start a theme. When I looked at what labs are doing the bulk of the pesticide testing, and again, this is, it's, remember that lab I mentioned that had been closed for the better part of a year and reopened under a new name and everybody jumped on board with them again? Out of the gates in April, they were doing 84% of the pesticide testing volume in the state. The second month, when some of the other labs came on board a little bit more, however, they were doing 62.6%. So they're basically that one lab of the six or seven that now, six I think it is, that are capable of doing pesticide testing in the system. This one lab's doing almost two-thirds of the business right out of the gates. So an awful lot of people, remember, for 7 years, 8 years now, our farmers, our regulated farmers, for the most part, with the exception, notable exceptions of, you know, Trailblazing Productions and Washington Bud Company, and, you know, folks who were doing it medical for a while, where they were regularly being tested for pesticides and heavy metals. Well, now that everybody is, I mean, for 7-8 years, they didn't have to worry about pesticides for all intents and purposes. You know, there was very little regulatory oversight unless someone complained. And that was typically the agents would come in and see if they could find pesticides on site. The LCB, of course, has done some pesticide testing with the Department of Agriculture. But to see the lab that was closed because their quality assurance stuff was not up to snuff, and that everybody was accusing, or a lot of people were accusing, of being one of the worst cannabinoid inflators in the history of this short-lived market, the farmers really embraced them when they came into having to do pesticide testing. And I don't know, if you had to speculate about that, I'd speculate, and I don't have to speculate, but I've been doing a lot of it this last week. Why would so many farmers, even more that are presumably going to them for potency assessments historically, why would more farmers go there for their pesticide testing rather than one of the established labs that's been doing it for years and frankly doing it right, you know, in some instances? And I'll leave that to your imagination. But let's just say the fact that now there's pesticide testing happening all over the market, two-thirds of it is being done by them.
So what pesticides are they testing for? Do you have that information at the top of your hand, or is it a specific family of chemicals they're looking for?
Off the top of my head, that's actually a funny question. It is a funny question. I do actually know what they're testing for. Not in order. It's a lot of them. Different labs appear to be testing for different analytes, just from frequency distributions I've looked at. Okay. But just to name some names that people know, probably, abamectin, acephate, asquinosyl, acetaminoprid, adcarb, azostyrobin, bifenazate, boscalid, carbaryl, carburofen, chlorantraniliprole, chlorfenapyr, clofentazine, cyfluurine, diazinon, oh, that's good. Dichlorvos, ones that we know and love. So I'm just going to do those. Imidacloprid, I've heard about before. Malathion, methamyl, methiocarb, methylparathion. I'm not reading them all. Myclobutanil, that was a big one.
Yeah.
Permethrins, paclobutrazol, and a whole bunch more. Spiromethicin, spinosad. Thiocloprid, trifloxystrobin, which I've never heard about. That seems to be a very popular one to test for some reason. But they're doing a lot of them. And in total, in total, since they're people are reporting them two different ways, you know, for Christ's sake. It's just one of my database peeves. They're reporting in either parts per million or micrograms per gram, which is exactly the same thing.
Right.
There's 126 rows. So that means there's probably 63 analytes, assuming they both have that. I haven't checked that. There's around 60 things being tested for.
Okay, cool. So I'm not a chemist, but I recognized, I think, and I'm probably saying it wrong, pyrethrins on that list, and also spinosad.
Could be. Yeah, pyrethrins are on the list. Spinosad's in the list. Yep.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, and not everybody's testing everything just from looking at the frequency counts. Like, so example, some of the labs are doing, or one of the labs maybe is doing thiamethoxam. I haven't tried to figure out who's doing what yet. That's just another crosstab and some time. These names really freak me out. Bifenthrin is a very popular one as well. That's a very commonly tested thing, it looks like. So, you know, I'm just beginning to look into it to try to figure out which labs have higher and lower market share right now. You know, just looking at the quality of the data, you know, that's a good first step. And I was a little shocked when I saw that proportion, 2/3 basically of the pesticide testing in the state being done by one lab, and being a lab, by the way, that, you know, I decided some years ago that I would never knowingly consume product that had been tested by them. So.
Yeah, and then, like you mentioned, the LCB actually shut them down. And I just want to clarify for the audience, and I want to make sure I have this right too, all those pesticides you read off there are on a list that are allowed pesticides to use on cannabis. What they are testing for are levels over a certain amount set by the Washington State Department of Agriculture. And that just because they're testing for pesticides does not mean that the cannabis that you are consuming has no pesticides on them. Am I correct?
Oh, there's probably no cannabis on this planet that has no pesticides on it. My God, I mean, the water you drink has pesticides in it. The water the plants drink has pesticides in it. The point is how much.
Good point.
And, you know, when you're talking down in small numbers of parts per million or parts per billion, some things are measured in, those are very small amounts. Now, a part per billion of salt is not likely going to hurt you. A part per billion or two of,
glyphosate?
Botulinum toxin, you know,
okay.
In its thing is probably not a good thing to get in your system. You know, it really depends. People that shoot for zero, you know, it's great to have goals. Like, I'd like to climb Mount Everest in 5 minutes, but, you know, it's virtually unachievable given how we've already, you know, thrown stuff around so wildly as we do. You know, you look at maps around the state, and a lot of our farms, particularly our outdoor farms, are, as you might reasonably expect, set up in agricultural districts where there has been a long tradition in the state of growing things commercially. Mm-hmm. Things which typically get attacked by bugs and, you know, for many years were relatively unregulated, and for many years have been very well regulated, in some people's opinion, mine included, by the State Department of Agriculure. So no, it's zero pesticides. Doesn't mean it's very possible that farmers have not been adding any to the system intentionally, and a lot of them do market themselves that way, and I think a lot of them are actually like that way. What the LCB requires now, which is a good thing, is that when you use pesticides, you have to list them on your label. You know, so neem oil and stuff like that. I'm not sure the all details. To the point that someone made earlier, it may have been Dick, about these pesticides are just ones that are allowed, but they're checking the levels. I think some of these are actually also not, that is correct, some of them. For most of them, but some of them are actually not allowed at all, and they're just checking to make sure they're not there.
Okay.
You know, there's ones that, and but even they're not there. You know, they've got kind of like a zero tolerance list, and that's the ones that, you know, but zero tolerance to them, I think, is like 2 parts per billion or something. I have not been following all of the micro details of that recently because they changed so much in this last set of rules. They changed some things that really disgusted me, and so I just didn't bother to go into it any much more. I didn't need any more grief. So, you know, what the LCB did in setting these rules up is they basically made a soundbite that now they're like everybody else and we test for pesticides in this state. And that's true. I can't argue with that. But we're not like everybody else. We're somebody who had farms develop their skills and their processes over almost a decade with virtually no oversight on pesticides. And with a strong, much stronger than many of the other states, incentive to produce at the lowest price possible because our LCB, bless their heart, and they, by the way, Lucas seemed to be waking up to the fact with all this canopy stuff that they're mumbling out of their asses recently. But they're worried about, they basically licensed many times more canopy than they were originally advised was necessary to supply the entire needs of the state. And by current estimate, that's my estimate, and I've been following this stuff for years pretty closely, there's probably about 5 times, would be my best guess if held to it, production going on in the state, or production capacity active in the state, than is necessary to supply the entire needs for cannabinoids of Washingtonians, both regulated and unregulated. So, you know, we got farmers out there that are producing five times as much as we need in the state, and a heck of a lot more than five times as much as the regulated market needs in the state. So, you know, that's a real formula for driving prices into the dirt.
Yeah, and they are pretty cheap out there. One of the things I've noticed about flower in the stores is I've really started to notice that it seems like it's almost all the same strain or close to sort of the same cannabis. And breeders warned us about this going back. Would you like to make any kind of comment on that?
I have not looked at the data. I've got it, you know, but I haven't looked at the data recently on strain diversity of strains, basically, is what you're getting at. Yeah.
Well, they make up the names. You know what I mean? It's just they'll say one is one and another is another.
They absolutely do. And probably the best example I've got of that was, it's funny because, you know, a lot of the oil producers are really big on, you know, this is Durban Poison, this is Blue Dream. They're very strain specific. You know, mm-hmm. We source only from Farm X, and we have their A bud, and we do it only with God blessed, you know, Czar vodka or something like that for an extract. However they do it, when we did the Ike's OK program, which was came really out of frustration and concern for consumer safety on the part of one of our big retailers in the state, you know, Uncle Ike's, basically, that chain, they were concerned about the spiral to the bottom, about how prices were being driven down into the dirt, and that some of that was based, you know, a significant amount of it was based on these fraudulent labs, that you could grow shit, and if you can get a lab that'll, you know, give you 30% THC and pass your mold-infested, bug-riddled fish as, you know, good enough quality for your Washington regulated consumers, then, you know, why bother to spend the money to do it better? Anyway, on the oil, where you don't see the flower that it came from, we've found in one instance an oil that... is it an oil or flower? So this was a flower, actually, in this case. But it was a flower that tested dirty, and it was for pesticides. And the finger pointing that started almost immediately, it was an oil, but it was from a specific farm, and it was a farm with a good name. And so people presumably had some marketing cash to buy it. Well, when we posted the results that it failed pesticide testing, there was a big backlash, and it was fun to see it from sort of being part of the system, because I got copies of lawyer letters and stuff like that sent to me. And so it was kind of a lot of fun. But what it basically came down to is the farm who was on the label as being the one it was sourced from, you know, because those UBI numbers used to be on the label, or the license numbers, they probably still are. That farm said it wasn't us. And the oil manufacturer said, yeah, it wasn't you. It was these little guys, these little nothings that we do business with once in a while. So they basically, both of the big players in the game that just got caught selling dirty pesticide stuff, effectively said, I'm sorry, but our label's wrong. We said it was the wrong stuff. And a subsequent one to that, again, it was an oil concentrate. This was later in the program, when it became OK Cannabis program, and they were sourcing from multiple stores, multiple chains, for testing. We found an instance, not we, they found an instance. It was a really nice piece of work by Confidence Analytics, one of the labs of the market. And there was this oil that, you submit five vials of oil, you need a lot of oil to do all the tests. And they basically found that there were at least two distinct types of oil in that, those five different cartridges that we took off the shelf, and they all had exactly the same, or they took off the shelf, they all had exactly the same, you know, lot number. They're presumably from the same batch of oil, and they were clearly different, right? Not just little different. And I thought that was fun because, you know, that again went a little bit back and forth, and people were basically saying lab doesn't know what they're doing, but it became another way of interpreting it is that was a manufacturer, and they're one of the bigger oil manufacturers in the state. They got a real good name and a real good rep, which is undeserved in my experience, what I've seen and how they behave. But they're basically, I mean, it appeared to me as if they were defrauding their consumers. You know, they were basically saying whatever they wanted to on the label, and it effectively had nothing to do with what was in the bottle, other than it's something that certainly feels like a cannabinoid when you smoke, when you vape it. And, you know, God knows where it came from. That's what this market has become. And those folks that are doing the kind of what I would consider to be consumer fraud thing as a matter of business, as a matter of business process, or inadvertently because of some offshoot of the processes that they've chosen, whatever they're doing it, when it is done, it puts the consumers at risk, and it really becomes a problem. But you know, to your strain thing, you don't even know what you're buying when you do it. And your other observation I thought was pretty good, that you're seeing less diversity just in appearance sake from the bud that's in those things.
Mm-hmm.
That's because a lot of people are being driven to three things likely. They certainly want to have as high a cannabinoid content as they can. That seems to really be a big thing for 60 to 70 to 80% of the consumers in the state. You know, you get more money for high THC than low THC typically. Not only that, but it moves off the shelves quicker. You know, so you get velocity of money as well. Also, you know, with respect to passing or failing quality assurance stuff, you know, if a lab will pass anything, then you don't have to worry about it too much. But to be able to get big yields out, which is something that people want, they want to get as much dollar per gram as possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's the potency gaming. They want to get as much product as possible, you know, per light or per square foot of canopy. So that's a lot of the brand selection right there, what yields heavily. And then a third thing, and at least used to be, and probably still is for many farmers, knock on wood, is they want something to be relatively pest resistant, because to get the really big yields out of a limited square foot facility, which all of ours are limited square foot facilities, certain strains are better than others. And you got to, you know, there comes a point where you want to pack them in as densely as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just kind of physics says that. There is, of course, a trade-off that it becomes unhealthy for the plants in many ways to be spaced too close together. You know, and one of those things is lack of airflow, increased local humidity, and increased mold, mildew, and botrytis and stuff, and then pests, other pests. So, yeah, strain, you know, it really comes down in many things, at least in Washington's market. Know your farmer and trust them or don't, but don't look at the label and assume that the stuff that the state requires to be put on there is as accurate as one might assume. I mean, it just, there's fewer strains out there than there used to be. There's still a lot of them. I really worry that we're losing some of the diversity because it makes sense for someone, you know, a lab can push potency only so far without getting caught.
Right.
Or kind of what is that, you know, people are going to tend to grow higher, presumably THC, in some cases, hopefully higher CBD strains than others, but they're going to tend to grow higher THC strains. And there's a relatively few number of those. I mean, they start going down a certain branch of the old cannabinoid family tree.
Right.
And a lot of the diversity of cannabinoids and terpenes and all that good stuff that's available in the plethora of medicinal brands that used to be common are perhaps being lost. And I get a little worried, you know, this is a biological thing.
Mm-hmm.
If nobody's growing it, and not that everybody's spending all their time and attention growing something else.
Right.
You know, these things will eventually become lost. And you know, that kind of scares me. And the people who are trying to keep them alive, you know, are in many instances illegal right now. And
right. Or small batch home growers that don't have a lot of square footage to work with, so they can't run large breeding programs to repopulate this stuff once the market realizes its error.
Right. And in this state, those small batch home growers, to be legal, you know, they've got to be basically patients.
Right.
Registered. I don't know if they have to be registered or not, but if you want to do a bunch of plants, which is, I think, up to 15, you got to be registered to
correct. Right. Correct.
But if you're not, you can only do up to God, I forget if it's 5 or 6, you know, and there's a big catch 22 there with regards to the federal asset forfeiture if they want to.
Yeah, so, I think it's 4 plants that you can grow without being registered. And yeah, over 5 is you can have forfeiture. Yep.
Yep. Yeah, and God help you if you have a firearm in the house or something like that, or kids. You know, it's, or you want to, you know, be in public housing or, you know, have federal benefits or anything. It's, yeah, a bit problematic. So, yeah, I'm worried about that. It'd be a shame if that happens. It is, I think, happening. I just haven't looked at the data closely enough to see it. One thing I did, I'm just on strain. When the market first started, I did do a strain count. Like, this was way back in 2014, 15. Mm-hmm. And over the first 6 or 8 months of the market, it was like Blue Dream represented some ridiculous fraction of the plants that had been put in the ground. It was funny, and I didn't know anything about plants or strains back then. And so I asked a bunch of people, and they all, you know, thought, chuckled a little when I asked the question. But they all told me, it's reliable as hell, it yields, you know, it's nice, and it's pest resistant, relatively pest resistant. So a bunch of people that were scaling up to bigger rows than they'd ever done in some cases, were trying to hedge the bets in their favor. And so the market was just, you know, over flush with Blue Dream's versions for the first year and a half.
Yeah, really interesting how they're, and I really appreciate that answer telling us why the strains are kind of getting up in the corners. You know, they're just breeding it more yield, more THC. And yeah, eventually you're going to kind of get to the same plants, because some plants are definitely more difficult to grow than others, and they don't grow right, they don't produce enough. I had a cherry pie. I just had to get rid of it out of my grow because it was always growing too slow. So it was a really great plant, but it just took forever to grow. And if you're doing that on a commercial basis, you got to get rid of them. But Zoom is telling us that our meeting was going to end real quick. Is there anything else you wanted to leave us with, Jim? And if people want to find out more about what you're doing in the Washington State regulated market, where can they find more information?
Well, if they want to find out, you know, more about me and the stuff I've written, I have a blog. It's easiest way to get to it is www.highintelligence.org, H-I-G-H, intelligence, all one word, .org. And that'll take you directly to my blog page under my commercial page. But one thing I would close on, and it's really the move of the LCB away from a traceability, seed-to-sale traceability capability, and into this compliance reporting world that they're creating. Mm-hmm. It seems to meet their needs in some way, and I don't completely understand those. I will admit to that. However, why do we add traceability in the first place? It was because the feds wanted to make sure that there was a tightly regulated market, you know, one in which hundreds of tons of product wouldn't suddenly be getting grown by legal growers and sent out of state, you know, to non-legal states, stuff like that, going to kids, all those bad things. When you have a traceability system in state in place, you've got a source of information that is really, really, you know, helpful for a lot of things. It can tell you, it can inform governance, it can inform legislators, it can inform, you know, the health department, the agricultural department, policy makers, enforcement decisions. It can do all kinds of things. And what they've created with the CCRS, you know, it's a system that on paper has all kinds of the data, and I'm relatively new at it, so I'll cut it some slack. But I'm seeing a system where, you know, there weren't even any pesticide data being captured in it for the first 3 months or 5 months, 3 to 5 months of its operation. Hmm. You know, I'm trying to trace down labs right now. Like, I've got all kinds of lab data, and there's a lab ID number in there, and I can't find all the lab. Like, I know it's lab 10 or whatever, you know, the number is, but I don't know what it is. And I can find no reference in any of the relevant tables on this thing to find it. Hmm. So it appears to be possibly a well-designed database. I'm going to reserve judgment on that, but a very poorly executed one, in that people can enter apparently whatever they want. And it's picking them up and it's letting them go. So when I see micrograms per gram versus parts per million, for the pesticide things, again, those are the same measure. Why have two different ways of reporting it that are allowed? Mm-hmm. You know, from a data analysis perspective, it makes it a pain in the ass. So, it decreases the transparency into what's going on. And I'm just going to say this: God help the LCB if they ever have to really do a product recall to A, be able to execute that efficiently, and B, if there's somebody, if there's an instance where people are getting poisoned from something, some product, you know, God hope this doesn't happen, from some oil, let's say, that they had out there, just try to trace it upstream into where the source of that contamination ultimately came. And, you know, I really do believe they're going to have a problem doing that. So it's, as a consumer right now, I think consumers in this state of regulated cannabis, corks as I call them, should be concerned that basically if they're purchasers of regulated cannabis, they're basically highly likely to be victims of fraud. Just with respect to the what they bought is not what the label said they bought.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Quality West Cannabis. Learn more at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com. So now it is on to our It's a Bust, and this is the part of the show where we look at the drug war going on in the United States and around the world and the effect it has had on our communities. And in this one, we are going to go down to the Caribbean. And this is an interesting story. It involves two islands, Trinidad and Tobago, and this guy all got started. Well, they saw a guy there, and then what happened, Dig?
Well, so this is in Barbados. It's a complicated story. So a Colombian national was arrested with a cannabis with a street value of Trinidad and Tobago $72.04 million, which is probably around like 15 million U.S.
Yeah, it was about 1,000 pounds.
A lot of weed. And it was this this guy came, like flew in this flight, and they caught him at the stash house.
Yeah.
In Barbados.
Yeah, and they kind of got it. It was interesting how they all got it going. They kept the investigation going for a while, but they came across the guy in Trinidad. Then they alerted Barbados, and they got this whole back and forth going, and they basically just watched them until the 1,000 pounds came in.
Yeah, it's wild, and it's also, you know, it shows that the drug war is still going strong, but people are still smuggling large amounts of cannabis all over the world.
Yeah, and Colombia is loosening up its legal cannabis industry. They're selling legal cannabis all the time in Colombia. I think even high THC is going to be exported pretty soon. So
I almost wonder if that's going to increase the quality of black market cannabis like it has in the U.S. Like, for instance, in the U.S., since legalization, I would say that the quality of black market cannabis in a legal state has gone up, because better quality cannabis is getting smuggled from legal states into legal states.
Yeah.
I think the same thing is going to happen with Colombia internationally. Now that they're cultivating it legally, it's going to be of better quality, one would think, because they can operate more freely.
Yeah, and it did seem in the article that this was kind of a – I'm sure it was a bigger operation. It was like a big operation, but it didn't seem like they put a lot – in it to pull it off, you know what I mean? So yeah, because right. Because there's probably so much cannabis floating around Colombia now, like there's always been, but even more now because of the, I mean, what we call that in the United States, they call that diversion. And if you were tuned right in, you heard the interview with Jim. So very interesting stuff going on in cannabis. That's why we just need to decriminalize it everywhere, legalize it, let people grow, and then let them everything kind of sort itself out. And that is the Cannabis Corner for this week. I hope everybody's having a great week, and I want to thank everybody for joining us. I want to thank Jim for being on the show. I want to thank Dig for coming on the show, and hope you have a great week, Dig.
Yeah, you too, Lucas.
If you have questions or would like to comment on the show, you can reach us at thecannabiscorner840@gmail.com. To listen to back episodes or to subscribe to the show, find us all across the internet by searching The Cannabis Corner. How can folks get in touch with you, Dig?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Uncle Dig, and you can listen to my podcast, The Bagseed Chronicles, wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you to Radio Tacoma and KTQA for their continued support. I'd also like to thank Aaron Foles for his production assistance. And
And finally, thank you for joining us on the Cannabis Corner.